Okay, so Erev Tov, I'm speaking here from Alon Shavuot on a very rainy evening. We feel like God is blessing us this evening with good rain, which is a great thing. We really need it. It hasn't rained yet this season. We're going to talk tonight about the Ibn Ezra. And last week we started talking about Rashi and his approach to Midrash. This week we're going to talk about the Ibn Ezra, and I hope that, you know, we were slowly going to go through different Mepharshim, Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, and then our last classes will all be case studies where we'll take a particular text and actually analyze the three approaches on a given text. So let's talk about the Ibn Ezra. As we know, Rashi, the Ramban, the Ibn Ezra, the Radak, all of them are in a sense contemporaries. The Ibn Ezra, born in 1090, died in 1164. He is one of the Chachmei Sfarad. Now, the Ibn Ezra, he had a particularly difficult life. He was quite incredible in the fact that the areas. He was somebody who wrote about astronomy, he wrote about philosophy, mathematics, and he was incredibly prolific in that area, writing and produced books on these things. One area in which we all know him for is his grammar. He wrote a lot about grammar, and this actually plays a very important part in his life. You see, he was the first one of, I think if you've ever, I'm sure everybody here looking at the names, I imagine everybody's learnt the Ibn Ezra, and I think that sometimes we enjoy the Ramban, but the Ibn Ezra is particularly difficult, and one of the questions is why. Well, you see, out of all the Chachmei Sfarad, most of them wrote in Arabic. For example, the Kuzari is written in Arabic. And the most famous book of the Ibn Ezra, which is the one we're going to talk about, is his Perush al HaTorah. Because it was sort of the first, he had to invent new words and create phrases. That was part of the problem. Another part of the problem was that he used all sorts of philosophical language, mathematical language, and not everybody quite got the Ibn Ezra. And therefore, we will see that because of his exceptional, for example, we all know the word Efes in mathematical language means zero. I don't know if too many people realize that the Ibn Ezra invented that word. He was the one who invented the word Efes in its, I mean, Efes we see in the Torah. But he invented it as meaning zero. That's something not too many people know. Even in his Perush, there are certain phrases he uses, technical language, which aren't customarily used. For example, if you see the word v'ha'ed from the word edut, v'ha'ed, that always means, doesn't mean, and there is a testimony or something like that. What it means is that this is the proof. The ha'ed means the proof is. Or for example, he'll say this perush, the ha'tam, etc., etc. Now he doesn't mean the reason, as in ta'ameh ha'mitzvot. What he usually means is the ha'ed means, and zot ha'raya, this is the proof. For example, he talks about chazal. He doesn't call them chazal. He calls, is it based on efes ki ata'am? There's no doubt the word Efes, used in many different places, as you're quoting from the Meraglim, of course means but, right? It's some negation. So the ultimate negation is zero. That's the ultimate, you know, lack of a number. Efes, kiata'am, yes. But, you know, it's an extrapolation. It's not an exact correlation, if you know what I mean. So another, for example, for Chazal, he uses the phrase ma'atikin. The copiers, sort of like what we use in our Shmona Esrei, sofrim, pleitat sofrehem. Sofrim being because they used to copy things down. A lot of the time, the Chachamim were those who, and frequently probably a chachamim would write their own books. They would have to copy out a volume of shas or something like that in order to be able to learn it. So one of the difficult things about Ibn Ezra is simply his language. It's his language which makes him very complicated. He existed in Spain in a chabura, in a group of Talmidei Chachamim. For example, he talks in his perush about his conversations with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and others. Certainly the Sephardi world are very familiar with his piyutim. He was an exceptional Paitan, a poet, and many of his piyutim even feature in Mirot's books, and more of them are said by the Sephardi community. The last thing I wanted to talk about was his very difficult life. He wandered from place to place, sometimes because of religious persecution at the hands of the Muslims or the church, whatever it might be. For example, he escaped Spain to go to Italy. In his life, he even makes it to London in his Perush about Choshech, the Makat Choshech. Ibn Ezra talks about what is Choshech, by Yamesh Choshech, being able to feel the darkness in some way. And he says, when I was on the English Channel, when I was traveling to England, then I felt Choshech in an incredible way. And maybe that is the same Choshech. So he travels around, and he had a very difficult life. His son, awful things befell his son. And if you look at the sheet that I sent you, you'll see a poem that he writes about himself. This is the light comedy, if you want, to start the shir. Galgal Umazalut, a poem. By the way, there is a website somewhere which has all his poetry on it. You can search around, you'll find it. This is called Galgal Umazalut. We said he was into astronomy. Galgal Umazalut from Ma'amadam, I mean the small print at the top. Galgal Umazalut from Ma'amadam, the planets and all of the stars, Matuba Malacham the Moladati, they leaned, if you want, they took special attention to me. In what way? Lu Hayu Neirot Schorati, Loyech Soch Shemesh Admoti, Loyech Soch Shemesh Admoti. In other words, if I would be trading in candles, the sun would never go down. Igal Hatzliach Polo Uchal, I try and be to make some money, but I never manage to. Ki Tuni Kochavei Shamai, because the stars are against me. Lu Ehiyeh Socher B'Tachrichin. If I was trading in garments for the dead, Lo Yigva'un Ishim B'Chol Yamai, nobody would ever die. The Ibn Ezra, here in a sense of self-comedy, talks about his misfortune, but it's not only for his biography that we've come to talk about, but we want to talk about exactly how he wrote his Perush. Today we're going to focus, and there are many things to talk about his Perush, the questions of, for example, many of you will know that in certain points he is very untraditional, and we're going to touch on those. I call this class between traditionalism and rationalism, because we really see both those sides in the Ibn Ezra. Let's get on very clearly and start looking at comments from his Hakdamah to the Torah. In his introduction to the Torah, the Ibn Ezra gives five modes of interpretation, five different ways to understand the Torah. It's actually a beautiful introduction written in poetry. And he actually uses a very interesting metaphor. He talks about there being a sort of a circle and a bullseye in the middle of the circle. And each explanation he measures how close it is to the bullseye, is it outside the circle completely. And he uses this metaphor to describe five different approaches. The first being philosophical, a philosophical approach to the Torah. If I'm not mistaken, he says, this is the circumference of the circle. Then he talks about the tzidukim, the people who understand the Torah without Torah Shemot Heh. As far as the Ibn Ezra is concerned, this is outside the circle. Then other people understand the Torah as an allegory, that's the third approach. And he rejects that too. He talks about Chazal's approach, traditional approach that you'll find in the Talmud and the Gemara. And he says this is very close to the center, but his beloved way of understanding Torah, as many of you know, is Pshat. And if you look at source number one, he explains why. ki shikul hadat hu hayisod. El shikul hadat, our mind, that is the foundation. Ki lo nikma ha-Torah l'asher ein da'at lo. Because Torah is not given to somebody who has no intelligence. And listen to this exceptional phrase, v'ha-malach bein Adam u'bein Elohav hu sikhlo. The angel which mediates between God and man is man's intelligence. V'chol davar shahadat lo tachishenu. Anything which our intelligence does not contradict, kipshuto or mishpato mefarshim. He will explain it according to its pshat and mishpat. What he means by pshat is very different to Rashi. Rashi spoke about a connection with the text, but he understands it more like the way we read pshat, mishpat. How does the sentence go? V'na'amidenu al matkunto, we will establish it firmly. V'na'amin kikacha amito, just the text alone. The text standing alone, you'll understand that is its truth. We will not fumble around the wall like a blind person. Why should we turn something which can be seen, the text which is visible, why should we turn it to something which is hidden? Why should we put hidden things in the text? If there are really things which are from Chazal, or there are different readings. Mehem begufot, or mehem machshavot, kamilat basar, v'orlat libot, or v'eit hadat, sodin am, ki adbrim heim emet kamashma'am. First of all, you can see his poetry, he talks in rhyme. But he's going to talk about the importance of pshat. Now, the Ibn Ezra didn't write on the whole, or at least we don't have his perish on the whole of Tanakh, unfortunately. He might have written, and people do think that maybe he wrote a perish on all of Tanakh. We have a perish on HaTorah, and in fact, in certain cases, more than one perish on HaTorah. On Shemot, in the Torah Tzchayim, we have a perish Katsar, a perish Aroch, also two perishim on Bereshit. We don't have anything on Nevi'im Rishonim. Yishayahu we do have, Trei Asar we do have, Tehillim, Iyov, Chamesh, Megillot, and Daniel, but for example, I don't know, Divrei HaYamim we don't have, Mishlei we don't have, and I said, Yecheskel, Yirmiyahu we don't have. So it's only a partial perush. Everything I'm going to bring today pretty much comes from his perush al HaTorah. Let's start with his attitude, or rather, maybe I should already put it on the table, his rejection of drush. And I'm going to start off with the famous psukim in this week's parasha, where Yaakov meets Esav, and Yaakov bows down to Esav, and Esav ends up giving Yaakov a big bear hug. And he kisses him. Now you'll be aware there are all sorts of midrashim about this. For example, you might have learned in elementary school the famous midrash about Esau kissing Yaakov on his neck to try and kill him. And here in Peret Lamed Gimel, Vayarat Esav Likrato Vayichakehu Vayipolat Samaro Vayishakehu Vayivku. One of the reasons why people came up with the drash is Vayishakehu has dots above it. In medieval, nobody quite understands what exactly is the purpose of the dots. And in fact, in Midrash, there is a suggestion that when you put the dots there, well, that means that maybe something there isn't quite what it seems. It's interesting that in medieval manuscripts, if they were ever wanted to erase something, the notation for erasing something was to place dots above the letters, and that meant that you meant to erase something. So, Vayishakehu, he kissed him, but sort of not quite. So, did he kiss him with a full heart or not? That's the question Rashi raises. If an Ezra is not interested, he says, Hadrash al-Nekudot Vayishakehu, Tovhu la'atikei mishadayim. The drash of the dots on top of Vayishakehu is very good, la'atikei mishadayim. That means children. Ki al-derech hapshat, lo chashav Esav la'asot ra le'echad. Esav didn't want to do anything bad to his brother. And look now, the ha'ed. Remember we said the ha'ed means hara'ayah. Proof is, vayivku. They cried. If they cried, there must be real emotion there. In other words, here's the proof. Not just Vayishakehu the word, but there's some circumstantial evidence. Ka'asher asa Yosef imechav. When Yosef meets his brother, we don't imagine anybody's faking it. And therefore, likewise here, the implication is that Vayivku, it proves that the Yishakehu is sincere. I'll give you another example of his opposition to Drush. Bereshit Parash Haftalit, it says, Hashem Be'erachad Avraham B'kol. Look at Rashi. Anybody remember Rashi? Rashi says, B'kol means he had a daughter called B'kol. Strange explanation, I guess. If you want to be blessed by everything, you have to have sons and daughters. He didn't have a daughter, he can't be. He must be lacking something. Right, I speak of somebody who has both sons and a daughter. So definitely we would miss something if he didn't have a daughter. And Rashi says he had a daughter called Bakol. V'Hashem Be'erachad Avram Bakol V'Orech Yamim V'Osher V'Kavod U'Banim V'Zeh Kol Chemrata Adam. He says Bakol does not mean a daughter. It means long life, wealth, honor, and children. And that's what people really want. The Drash Shebito Haitza Shema Bakol. The Drash which says that his daughter was called Bakol. Tzarich L'Hosif Bet M'Sharet. He says it's non-grammatical. You would then have to add an extra bet. You would have to say B'Bakol, right? But it doesn't fix it doesn't match the grammar. Once again, if an Ezra is using textual evidence in order to prove his point of how to understand Pshat, let's see some other cases where he rejects Drash. Text number 4. You remember Avram in Perek Chafei Parshat Chayisara. Avram marries Keturah. I've tried to take examples from recent parashiyot so that they're fresh in our mind. Keturah. If you remember, Rashi says, and I think there's interesting midrashim here, but Rashi says Keturah is Hagar. Ibn Ezra rejects this. He says in other words, there were Pilakshim. Well, Sarah's his wife, but Pilegesh? Well, we only know of Hagar. Who are the Pilakshim? If you have Keturah, now you understand Pilakshim in the plural. Pilakshim is a plural. So, here again, a textual proof proves that Keturah Einena Hagar. And I brought another one from this week's Parashat Shavua. Maybe I should already precede this by saying that Rashi, in classic Midrashic tradition, has a tendency that whenever you find a spare name, or even double names, he will identify particular personalities with a different person. For example, in Bereshit Perek Dalet, you hear about Na'ama. A woman called Na'ama, the daughter of Lemech. And who is Na'ama anyway? Rashi thinks in Midrashic tradition that Na'ama is Eshet Noach. Or for example, two lads, two Ma'arim, accompany Avraham on his way to Dakeda. Who could they be? So what does Rashi say, bringing the Midrashic tradition? Eliezer and Ishmael. Why? Because which two other personalities do we know who could be his Ma'arim? The Ibn Ezra doesn't like this identification of names. Shifron Puah. Are Shifron Puah? They're not Yocheved and Miriam, otherwise we wouldn't call them Shifron Puah. Of course, by the way, the Midrash is puzzled by why you would talk about Shifra and Puah, who never feature in the rest of the story. Why would you tell us about Na'ama if we don't even know anything about her? And Na'ama, they explain as being, explaining her name. Na'ama, that she is Ne'imah, she is pleasant. Or Shifra and Puah, that Shifra would be Meshaper Havlan, Puah would do something else to the child, she'd go poo poo or something like that to help the Vlad, the child. In other words, a name can be understood as a personal quality rather than an actual name, and therefore people can hold multiple names and multiple identities, and frequently an empty identity is a cause for rereading the name in terms of its meaning. And we'll see another couple of examples of this. In this week's parasha, at the beginning of Perek Lamed Vav, where it lists all Esau's descendants, we see here, who Edom, who are the Edom? Oh, so and then it talks about his wives. The Alter Tamer al Ada u'Basmat. They talk about the wife of Esau as being Ada in one place and Basmat in the other place. So who are they? Rashi says they're the same person. He says Yesh la shtei shemot ki kein shem eim aviha. Ki kein shem eim aviha. Sorry, I'm reading it wrong. Shem aviha. Aviha, the Jewish king. You find that he had there are two accounts, one in Divraim and one in Sefer Malachim, and Abiyah had two different names for the mother. He says, well, it's obviously the same king, the same person, right? But there are two different names for the mother. Likewise, he says, Adal Basmat, we're talking about two different names of the same person, and it's not like Rashi says that Basmat is a drush of that she would bring Basamim to Avodah Zarah. He says, Adal Basmat, two names. Once again, rejecting the Midrashic approach. So that's one side of the coin. Maybe we can look at a couple of other very quick ones. In Bereshit, Perek Yudala, text number 5, if you'll be familiar with Avram going to war with 318 men, Rashi says he went to war with only one person, Eliezer. Eliezer is the Gematria of 318. Ibn Ezra rejects this totally. He says, Chani Chav, he went to war with his Chani Chav, Shechin Cham Chavim Rabot Benol Chama. So he trained in warfare with Gim Loni's car, even though that's never mentioned, the warfare, he did train them. And he says, V'cheshbon otiot Eliezer derech drash, to explain the word Eliezer as being the 318 men, is a drash, ki ein ha-katuv medaber b'gematria. Psukim don't work in gematria. Ki yachol ha-rotelot, he calls shein le-tov u-le-ra, you can explain any name. He doesn't like midrashei shemot. Rak Hashem k'mashmo. Name is a name. You can't say, you know, the name Alex is Aleph Lamed Kaf Tamas, but it's El and Kes for Kisei or something like that. No, Alex is Alex and that's it. You don't do a drush of a name unless it's explicitly said. In certain places where the Torah gives us the meaning of a name, like Abraham, Al-Hamon Goyim, or something like that. Okay, so what have we seen here? We've seen that the Ibn Ezra takes his own way, textual way. The question is, how does he relate to Chazal? Sachakol, Ibn Ezra is very, very from. Does he ignore Chazal? What about Chazal? I would like to show you two or three approaches that he takes to Chazal. One is going to be sort of a rejectionist of Chazal, and then in other cases it's going to be very accepting of Chazal. And we'll try and explain the reason for each. Text number 6, 7, and 8 are all going to focus around the same line. And it's a line he repeats. Im divrei Kabbalah, the Kabel. Or mi derech Sfara, ein zenachol. Or, in the Svara, not a Kabbalah. What does he mean? Kabbalah means not a mysticism. Kabbalah means Moshe Kibel Torah, Sinai, Masrali, Yeshua, Iskinim, the tradition, the Masorah. That's what we mean when we talk about Kabbalah. There are all sorts of things which appear in Torah, in our Midrash, and we don't know exactly how to trust them. You're familiar with the machloket, Sukkot. Was it Sukkot Mamash? Or was it Ananei HaKavod? How are we ever going to know? How are we ever going to prove? Did Abraham smash the idols? There's no textual proof. Should we accept it or should we not accept it? Was he thrown into the furnace? It's exactly about these things that Ibn Ezra decides to discuss. Let's have a look. Number 6, the famous story of the Akedah. How old was Yitzchak at the Akedah? You might be aware that anybody who links the Akedah to the death of Sarah is going to have to say that Yitzchak was 37 at the time of the Akedah. Says the Ibn Ezra, Rabotinu Zichronon Nebracha, text number 6, Amru Shehaya Yitzchak Hashem Ekar Ben 37 Shamim Ve'im Divrei Kabbalah Nekabel. If that is the tradition, the Masorah will accept it. However, Omi Derech Svara, if they came at it logically, Eid Zonachon, I disagree. And he explains why in the next few lines. He says, hold on a second, he can't be too old, because if he was too old at the Akedah, it wouldn't be Avram's test, it would be his test. It would be, he would have to tie himself down, he would have to restrain himself. And he can't be too young, because it says about Yitzchak that he carried the firewood. So if he's only 5 years old, he can't carry the firewood. If he's 37, it would be a real test for Yitzchak. He says, I assume he must have been 12 or 13. I assume he was a young adolescent, who his father could overpower him. His father also had to hide the evidence from him when he said, Ayeh haseli ola. Avram responded, Elokim yirelo haseli ola b'di. Why? Because if he would have told him, he would have run away. In other words, if Ezra uses logic and cues from the pasuk to explain that he is not too old, not too young, however, he admits that maybe there's a tradition, an accepted tradition that he's missing. In divrei the Kabbalah, the Kabel, if Chazal was saying something which is halacha l'moshe mitzinai, medrash l'moshe mitzinai, maybe. I once heard that phrase, medrash l'moshe mitzinai, from Professor Irving Jacobs of Jews College in London. If it's medrash l'moshe mitzinai, then I accept it. However, if this is just conjecture, if it's just people's reading of the verses, then I have a different approach. Similarly, Avram being thrown into the furnace, but Ur Kasdim, number 7, so he explains the word, what is Ur Kasdim? So, Kamoneinu Amru Sheishnich Avraham Avinu B'Kivshana Eish. Our rabbi said that they threw Avraham Avinu to the Kivshana Eish. But Lo Nizkarzeh B'Katuv. It's never mentioned. The Inhi Kabbalah Lekabel K'divrei Torah. Here you see, if an Ezra isn't a hard-nosed shut man, he's willing to accept Chazal. He just says, look, remember his line that Hamalach ben Adam ben Elohav Gusichlo. All I have is my logic. God gave us the Torah to learn with logic. All I can do is use that logic. And what can I do? It doesn't say anything about the Kivshana Eish. If there's a Masorah, then I accept the Masorah, Kamuvan. But if it's shut, it's not there. A few lines later in Bereshit, he talks about another famous Rashi, Yiska, another famous Midrash classification. He says, Rashi says, Yiska is Sarah, and it's from the language of Nisicha, or Shesacha Beruach HaKodesh, that the Yiska, who is Lot's sister, that is Sarah, and it actually explains certain things of Shat, because Avram says he was already, Avram later on in Perek, Chaf of Bereshit says he was already related to Sarah in some way before he married her. Whichever way, the Ibn Ezra says, Yiska inena Sarah, or Mashin Emer, Kish Nikra'ah, Sarah Yiska, Ba'abur Shesacha, Baruch HaKodesh. If it says, if the Midrash says that Sarah is Yiska, because she was anointed with Baruch HaKodesh, Derech Drashu, Osvara, Lo Kabbalah. And here he says emphatically, this is not a tradition, the Ein Zo Dvar Mitzvah. You don't need to believe this. Interesting language. Number 8. He rejects Anani HaKabod. There weren't 7 Anani HaKabod if you ask Pshat. Again, there aren't. He says, number 8. Hine Shnaim Amuzim Heim Shemitchalfim Ahamishkan. Ve'im Kabbalahi Sheshiva Anani HaKabod Heyu Maniach Vartenu Menismach Al HaKabbalah. What's he saying again? There's nothing in Pshat to say that there were 7 Anani HaKabod. However, if there's such a Masorah, and the Masorah is really true, I'll accept it. But if somebody came up with it through some other means, a Svara, then I don't believe it. Okay, so let's summarize. Ibn Ezra will work on the given text. Ibn Ezra, however, has a respect for Chazal, but he still sides with Pshat whenever he can. And he gives this line that when there's a famous Midrashic tradition, okay, if that's Midrashic tradition, Masorah, I accept Masorah. But if you ask me according to Pshat, I'll accept it that way. Now, you can't... he says it in a minute. 1 second. Yes, beautiful. A great question. And that is going to be... The question here from Judy says, is there a body of accepted text that he accepts as Kabbalah? That is exactly going to be the difference we're going to make in our second section, the last 10 minutes today. We're going to talk about Midrashei Halacha. When it comes to Halacha, the Ibn Ezra is going to totally side with Chazal, and he's going to be willing to totally twist the pshat. And this is what's such an interesting dichotomy in the world of the Ibn Ezra. But when it comes to the Halachic tradition, Midrashei Halacha, he absolutely accepts Chazal. And he's willing to ignore the pshat, so to speak, or accept a difference in pshat for that. So we're going to see a real and pshat of narrative sections. I'll also 2 seconds mention one other difference. One thing we've got to say about the Ibn Ezra is, well, I'll mention two things. Number one is his style. He can be very, very acerbic, very biting, very insulting. And in the next two texts, we will see that. He's also got straight logic. But further than that, the Ibn Ezra also believed passionately in the integrity of the Torah text. He had no time, Rashi in a few places mentions the case of him, various annotations to the text of the Torah. Ibn Ezra totally rejects any playing around with the text of the Torah as we know it. I know that people will say, well, what about the Sod HaShneimasar? That's a sort of different topic. I'm talking about adjusting words, minor emendations, adjusting a word here and there. I'll give you an example in source number 9. In source number 9, we see the following. It's from last week's parsha. It says, "Enei Lea Rakot." Remember, Rashi says that Leah was crying. Her eyes were, in some way, soft and red because she'd been crying. So what do we have here? Rashi says, source number 9, Rakot means kamashma'o. She had some problem with her eyes. She had an eye disease, or she was nearsighted, I don't know. The Yesh Shalim, Lama Hayakein. Some people ask, why was she short-sighted? V'avor shechashru shemachshavot Hashem kumachshavotehem. They think that God thinks like they do. V'chol ha-nivraim ru'yot saratan ru'yot shavot. And everybody should be the same. In other words, he's saying to us, hold on a second, why should everybody's eyes be the same? Some people are long-sighted, some people are short-sighted, some people are tall, some people are short. I don't understand the question. What do you mean? Why were her eyes that way? Why was Rachel Yifat Torah and Yifat Mareh? Strange question. And then he says, Oven Ephraim Amar. Ben Ephraim, by the way, is the Ibn Ezra mentions him in many places as a Karaite. Ben Ephraim said, Yu Haser Aleph. What does Rakot? What does it mean, eyes are soft? All our eyes are soft. You put your finger in your eye, it's soft. So he explained that Yu Haser Aleph, there's an Aleph missing there, but Ta'amo Arukot. It should say, Enei Le'a Arukot, but they drop the Aleph. Ibn Ezra hates this sort of line of thinking. And the Ibn Ezra says, if I can drop an Aleph out of Arukot, I can drop an Aleph out of your name, Ben Ephraim. And I'm going to make your name, V'hu Haya Chaser Aleph. Ben Ephraim was lacking an Aleph. In other words, he is Ben Parim, son of cows. This is one of his insults. Ibn Ezra has no time for Karaites. He hates the Karaites. He's a very much a man of Chazal in that regard, and also a man of straight thinking. Breishit Chapei, V'oni Shalu, Lama Hashem, Lama Chasar Hashem Mamon Yitzchak. Why was Yitzchak poor? Ulayodienu Lama Chaser Moraimav. Maybe somebody will tell me why he went blind. What sort of a question is that, says Ibn Ezra? Life throws things at people. I mean, you know that Ibn Ezra had a difficult life. In fact, many people talk about the fact that Ibn Ezra is not bothered in any way about the fact that Yitzchak was poor, because he himself was poor. Again, I'm not sure that you can always connect people's biography with their parashanut, but we'll simply say that he says, you know, why was he poor? Why did Hashem make him lose his eyesight? I'd like to deal with two other places where I feel that source 11 and 12, I realize they doubled up the numbers, but source 11 and 12 deal with his attitude towards the faults of our Avot. In this week's parasha, Perek Lamed Hey, we have the sin of Reuven, and we all know that Pshat is Vayelech Reuven Vayishkav Umiyachal Tineged Shaviv, that Reuven somehow did a sexual act in some way with Bilhah, had relations with Bilhah. Of course, Rashi, in a famous Rashi, says that there was nothing sexual went on between them, but that he played around with his father's sleeping arrangements. He moved his father's bed from Bilhah's tent to his mother Leah's tent. What's the truth? I don't know what Ibn Ezra thought, but look at the way he writes. Ayech Ruvain, Yafeh Pirshu Rabotenu Bekusa Kalon Aron. In other words, I think what he's saying is, the rabbis engaged in a cover-up, and well done. We should expand and publicize the faults of the Avot. Interesting. Likewise, again, this week's parasha, Yaakov on his way to Beit El, after the whole story with Dina and Shem, they got to Beth El, and he says, Hasir et Elohecha Nechar, remove the foreign gods. And what exactly does that mean? The people were worshipping idols in Yaakov's house. Says even Ezra, Chalila Shishkav Chanavi im Abodot Elohe Nechar. How can it possibly be that Yaakov would have any association with Elohe Nechar? Or Peroshel Tinsa'enu, Parshat Vayelech Moshe. He explains in Vayelech. In Vayelech, by the way, he explains that in some way, these were ways of telling the future, but they weren't exactly gods, and they were legitimate, certainly in Chutz La'aretz, if not in Eretz Yisrael. But once again, you'll see the Ibn Ezra frequently trying to defend the Avot. So, his pshat, his textual readings, he's very attached to textual readings, and he doesn't want to use drush. However, we've seen a few mediating principles. Number one, he allows for famous traditions in Kabbalah in the Kabel, that he does allow for. That's number one. Number two, we have seen the fact that he protects the Avot, doesn't like to talk about the sins of the Avot, wants to see the Avot as role models, and better to hide their faults than to mention them. Okay, I'm not going to say end of section one. I know there's only like 8 minutes left, but we're going to move on to the other side of the Ibn Ezra, which is where the Ibn Ezra is very willing to abandon Pshat and go with Drash, and that is when it comes to halachic things. Let's look at his theory, text.
Can you hear me? I can't hear you. Me too. Bert Nussbacher.
I can't hear either.
Hello? Okay. Sorry about that. We just had a cut.
I can hear you again.
I hope you... Okay, great. So, sorry about that. We had a little power cut for momentarily, and it knocked me off. I had to get back in. Okay, we were at the beginning of the Midrashi Halakha. In his Atzama Torah, text number 11, below the line, Ibn Ezra says, Rak b'torot v'mishpatim u'v'chukim. But in, when it comes to basically laws, halacha, im matanu shnei ta'amim l'psukim, if we find two ways of understanding the psukim, ha'tam ha'echad kidirei ha'ma'atikim, and one way is like chazal, we said ma'atikim means chazal, shahayu kulam tzadikim, nisha'en ha'amitam v'lo safek v'yadayim chazakim. Then we will rely on them with strong hands. The chalila chalila meaning tarei v'metzidukim. Here once again you see that he had to deal with various Karaites and tzidukim, people who did not believe in Torah Shabbat Alper, and he's been very, very careful to keep away from them at all costs. The danger being that if you go too much in the direction of Torah Shebichtav, of just the letter of the Torah, then you will find yourself in the arena of the tzidukim. And therefore, he says at the end here, "Rak kavmoninu hayu haya emet, b'chol dibrehem emet, b'Hashem Elokim emet, yamseh et avdo b'derech emet." Our kavmoninu, Chazal, were true. All their words are true. God is true, and He will lead us in the way of truth. Let's deal with two examples, two or three examples, where he rejects the textual explanation, which he so loves, for Chazal's explanation. For example, in Vayikra, he's talking about the sacrifices, and it says, "V'tzamach yado." One hand, on the sacrifices, somebody would place their hands. It's sort of the same thing as when somebody places both hands on something, they do smicha. They rest their weight on it. They transfer in some way their authority. And we see that with Moshe passing the authority over to Yeshua, that he did smicha. This, we also talk about people becoming a rabbi, getting smicha, because the rabbi transfers his authority to the student. Likewise here, but it says, the samach yado, not samach yadav, but samach yado. So he says, hayani reme abshat ha, sheb yado ha achat hismoch. It seems like he only uses one hand. Ki derech ari ha-mishtaleach, eno kederech kol korban, alkei tshina katuv, rak. He says, only in the Sarim HaShtaleach we talk about two hands. In most cases we talk about Samach Yado. Where do we get the idea of two hands? Chazal. Yivrei HaMatikim. Kasher Matanu HaMatikim. When the rabbi says, Sheetiku Shekol Tzmicha B'Shtei Yadayim, that they use two hands, Samachnu Aleihem. A nice little pun there. We rely on them. In other words, we rest our hands on them, or they rest their hands on us. In other words, we rely on them. Another example, source number 13, is Devarim Perakate. Talking about malkot, lashes. You know, the idea that sometimes for certain crimes, you could have to have 39 lashes malkot. The pasuk there talks about 39, but it also says that he should be lashed kedei rishato, in accordance with his crime. Kedei rishatov mispar makot hayani re lanu sheish avod shiuka alav ester gam esrim upachot v'yoter. Maybe we should suggest that a lighter crime would you'd only get 5, but a more severe crime you would get 10 or 20 up to 39. V'ha'ed, and the proof is again that phrase v'ha'ed kedei rishatov. However, rak lo yasif ala arba'im. He says, and you know, you get the sense that he actually thought this was the pshat of the psukim. The pshat of the psukim, if you really look at it in pshat, was kedei rishato, it was adjustable with a maximum threshold of 39. But then he says, lulei divrei ha-kabbalah v'hu levado emet, if it were not for the words of Chazal, which is true. Well, the next one's the classic, ayin tachat ayin. I can't go through the whole paragraph here, number 14, but if you look at the last two lines, which are underlined, of course, an eye for an eye would indicate taking out somebody's eye. In the text here, he discusses how you can't really take out somebody's eye because who knows, you might blind him in one eye, but that eye might be more useful for him, or you might injure him further, and it won't be equal. And he deals with all of the logical problems that, in fact, the Gemara in Bava Kamma also deals with. But then he says, the Haklal, I mean the underlying bit in text 14, Lo nuchal lefaresh al derech mitzvot haTorah peirush shalem. But it comes down to it, just with pshat, we cannot give a complete explanation. Im lo nismoch al divrei Chazal. If we don't go with the rabbis. Ki kasher kibalnu haTorah min haAvot, because when we got the Torah from our forefathers, kein kibalnu Torah shebaal peh, likewise we received Torah shebaal peh, the oral law, the halachic tradition. Ein hefresh b'nehem, there is no difference. He says, how will you explain the pshat? It would be worthy to have his eye given for an eye if he won't give the kofro, if he won't pay. In other words, he abandons the pshat. The other two examples, 16 and 17, deal with a similar theme. The idea that when it comes to matters of halacha, his egeret HaShabbat is quite exceptional. Unfortunately, we have not time, but if you have an opportunity, you'll see he's arguing against number 16, the Rashbam's interpretation of Vayhi Erev Vayhi Boker, very concerned that it might affect people's observance of Shabbat. So let me just try and summarize. Ibn Ezra, between traditionalism and rationalism, on the one hand, Ibn Ezra states as his guiding principle that he will work with Pshat, with the text, with the words, and yet we see that he has a very interesting dialogue with Chazal. On the one hand, accepting that certain famous midrashim are possible, even though the text does not support them, and raising the possibility, in Kabbalah lekabel, I'll accept it if it is a tradition. Moreover, sometimes rejecting a more pshat explanation because of a situation where we want to, or at least preferring a midrash explanation to defend tzaddikim. Again, defending in a sense the power of tradition. But his full turnaround takes place in many midrashei halacha, where he feels that the actual pshat goes in contradiction to the text itself. For example, when it talks about tefillin or the zikaron meinecha, it should be a memory between your eyes. The Rashbam says the pshat is you should internalize the idea of tefillin. Says the Ibn Ezra Ad Khan, you can't say that. Sorry, zikaron meinecha refers to tefillin. Like Chazal say, it means tefillin. If you want to go with the Ta'amei HaMitzvot, that's very nice. But that's not the... He won't even go so far as translating it that way. Maybe out of danger that it will be understood literally and fall into the lap of the Tzedukim, but maybe simply out of his respect for tradition. So this is a very complicated world with the Ibn Ezra. There's tons more to say about the Ibn Ezra. In fact, I have another like 4 or 5 sheets of sources at home. And we will be dealing with them in future times. I want to thank everybody for being here. Sorry about the technical hitch in the middle, but sometimes we're susceptible. As I said, it's raining, and there was this power cut for about 1 second. Thank you for being here. I'll stay online for a little bit, and maybe I'll turn off my camera, but I'll stay online if anybody wants to ask questions or anything like that. I know not everybody has a microphone, but if you want to ask questions, now's a great time.
Hi, I wanted to discuss in the context of last week's shiur that because Rashi is the first Mefarish that's generally taught, that people tend to conflate, mix up Pshat and Rashi as being synonymous, and I know you also have difficulty with the fact that many people then take Rashi literally, and we have all these Midrashim literally. So I don't know how you teach an appropriate way of teaching kids Rashi that would reflect both Pshat as well as reflecting, a homiletic thing for this. And the other problem, of course, is that adults tend to carry over what they hear.
Okay, so let me try and deal with that, that question that I got from Bert. The question of how to teach Rashi. This is really a big dilemma. I remember once discussing this with Rav Aaron Nesenstein. Maybe I'll even go further before that. My mother was also a Tanakh teacher, and she always used to tell me that she was very particular to divide up Pshat and Rashi. She would tell the students when it was written in the text and when it wasn't. I know that I went to a school where they taught every Rashi as if it was Pshat. And they taught every Rashi as if it's Pshat, and I learned an enormous number of Midrashim, even though I didn't learn Pshat. The question is whether that's bad. Rav Lichtenstein didn't think it was bad. He said, when they study later on, they will find out what's what. People will later engage in the text, they'll understand this was a Midrash, and this was Pshat. When I said this to many of my students have turned around and said, but that's not the way it is, people never study it again. This really is an educational question. If you could, you know, I certainly am engaging frequently with students who are 18, 19 years old, and I'm teaching, hopefully, according to Pshat. When I teach Rashi, I try and illustrate what Rashi's doing. But when Rashi's not teaching Pshat, it's not Pshat. And hopefully I'm doing justice both to the text and to Chazal, which is what we want to do. Of course, Midrashim have enormous wisdom, but if they're understood at face value, I think frequently you're missing the point that Chazal were trying to make. Frequently they were illustrating things from a more poetic, phonetic, philosophical, literary perspective. So it is a big challenge for Rashi teachers. On the one hand, I side with learning Chumash Rashi. You learn incredible wealth of Ma'amrei Chazal and the ethical messages from, you know, who wouldn't want to remember the Rashi which talks about Yaakov preparing for battle in three ways from this week's Parsha, or even in Lavam Garti, V'Taryag Mitzot Shamarti. We all know that. That's part of our bedrock of our literature. On the other hand, it is a big challenge to teach text, and I think it needs a certain amount of sophistication. It's interesting, my daughter goes to a school, Orot Etzion in Efrat, where they used to only teach Pshat, and after a while they realized that was also a mistake, and they had to teach more Chtivei Chazal and more traditional learning. So, as educators, balance is needed, and I think as adults, or once kids already reach high school, certainly post-high school, Tanakh teachers have a real duty to learn, teach people how to make that dichotomy. I sometimes feel that people don't appreciate the degree to which Rush is Drush until I give them a separate course on Midrash. When I give a separate course on Midrash, they really understand what Drush is doing, then they start getting upset about Rashi. It's a big challenge as educators, and around our Shabbos tables, I think we have to, you know, I'll be the first in my Shabbos table to tell my kids, that's not Drush, but that's not Pshat, but it's interesting. And let's talk about it for a while. And my kids are very used to me saying what's Pshat and not Pshat. I once asked my kids, how do you know there's something in Midrash? So my son, Avi Noam, he's 11, at the time, was a year or two ago, he said, a Midrash is something which is too crazy to have happened. So I said to him, well, what about Kriyat Yom Suf? What about Kriyat Yom Suf? That's crazy. So he said, okay, it's something crazy which isn't in the Torah. So that was, you know, an interesting 10-year-old definition. It's an educational challenge, that's what I can say. But I hope that answers the question. I see from Ken. Is Ken still on? Yeah. Ken, is it normal for a Karaite to read the text differently than that which is written? In other words, adding an Aleph. I don't think he really did add an Aleph, but there are other cases where people try to do it. For example, I have it somewhere here in my notes. For example, if you look in Shemot Perek Yutet, there's another case of Ibn Janach trying to make a textual emendation. For example, where it says Hagbelet Ahar v'Kidashto, and he wanted to read it Hagbelet Am. And once again, Ibn Ezra gets very, very upset about that. There are, I don't know if it's a Karaite thing, but it was certainly something that some people suggested. In certain cases that a word was somewhat wrong, and as I mentioned, Diktu Kei Sofrim, Rashi even in some places mentions Chazal adjusting a text, and Ibn Ezra rejects that.
By the way, I thought that your I subscribed to your virtual Beit Medrash thing last year, and And I thought your Eglon Arufa thing was particularly interesting.
Thank you very much. Okay. Erev Tov, everybody.
It was by the way, it was extremely controversial when I transmitted it to some of the people in our shul. So, but in any event, I can stand with controversy.
I try. The truth is, most of the time, I try definitely not to be controversial, and I try to tread a very. I'm not one of these radical teachers or thinkers. I definitely try and stay on the conservative small c side of things. But okay, all right. Thank you very much, and Erev Tov.
Shabbat Shalom.